This is 5 o'clock shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight in New York. Our theme today is protest and the methods thereof. We'll have an audio verite tour of a recent guerrilla action of students and occupiers in the middle of the streets of New York City, and a look at the radical student casserole pot and pan protest in Quebec, Canada, over tuition fees as well as repressive protest legislation. We'll speak about protest by hearing Saul Alinsky, the legendary organizer of the 1970s, on the subject. Also, the latest on the potential extradition to Sweden and then the United States of WikiLeaks founder and editor-in-chief Julian Assange. This is 5 o'clock shadow. This is 5 o'clock shadow. On the Pacifica Radio Network, I'm Robert Knight in New York. Late last week, there was a new tactic employed by the Occupy Wall Street movement, the unannounced sudden street manifestations to stop traffic and call attention to salient issues. In this case, tuition costs in New York and elsewhere, and anti-protest legislation in Quebec, Canada. Your reporter was there on Manhattan's 2nd Avenue during the twilight hours of the day, and we now hear the event unfold in stereo audio verite.
Crossing 14th Street. They are protesting student fees. The spearhead of the march is now exactly in the center of 2nd Avenue, now approaching 15th Street. Excuse me, what are you doing and why? What?
In Quebec.
Yes, Quebec, Canada. Yes, yes.
We are here.
We are here.
In solidarity.
In solidarity.
With the students of Quebec.
With the students of Quebec.
They have been marching.
They have been marching.
For the past 107 days.
For the past 107 days.
The government has passed emergency laws.
The government has passed emergency laws.
That now makes protesting illegal in Quebec.
Go!
traffic is now blocked on 2nd Avenue as spontaneous protesters march north on 2nd, now between 16th and 17th Street, with traffic seeming to be stalled or delayed as far north as 23rd Street. In what they say is solidarity with the students of Quebec, who for quite some weeks and months now have been protesting repressive legislation with severe penalties for those students who are arrested at a public protest, and consequences and financial penalties for organizations to which they are identified as belonging. What are you doing?
Not answering any questions right now.
All right, thank you. Robert Knight, WBAI.
Oh, you're WBAI? Quebec student, marching with the students in Quebec for solidarity. Marching in solidarity with the students of Quebec.
They passed some laws. What do they mean?
That it makes it illegal to protest, and you can't, wearing a mask can get you 10 years in jail. And they made laws that make it illegal to protest with more than 50 participants.
Thank you. Is this part of Occupy or spontaneous or what?
It is Occupy.
All right.
Thank you. What you doing?
We're marching in solidarity with the students of Montreal who have been on strike for 110 or 111 days now. They've been striking to protest a 75% tuition increase in their student loans. And as you may or may not know, student debt here in America is already at $1 trillion, and it's expected to double within the next year or so. So we're going to be marching here in the streets every night with the students in Montreal until there are some changes.
Is this part of Occupy?
Yes.
Is this a new springtime for Occupy after a winter period of quietness and police tactics that minimize public gatherings?
Well, the winter wasn't very quiet. It depends on who you ask, I guess. But yes, this is part of our spring awakening from hibernation.
Thank you. Robert Knight, WBAI.
Nice to chat with you.
This is 5 o'clock Shadow on the Pacifica Radio Network, originating at WBAI. I'm Robert Knight, and you just heard an audio verite of a recent protest, a spontaneous one that stopped traffic along 2nd Avenue. And just as suddenly as the protesters appeared, poof, they were gone, back into the streets of a twilight New York City, part of what may be a new set of tactics for the Occupy movement. They were protesting on behalf of students in Quebec, Canada, who are facing some very severe legislation. And to help go into deeper detail on that, we are now joined by Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent journalist who has been following this story. Welcome to 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Thanks very much for having me.
What are Canadian students protesting?
Well, in the province of Quebec, we've been on strike since February 13th, protesting against a planned tuition hike of 75%. Now, Quebec has the lowest tuition in Canada, at about an average of less than $2,500 per year. But we also have the lowest student debt in Canada, which amounts to an average of $13,000 compared to the average Canadian student debt at $27,000. The average American student debt is at $24,000. So basically, Quebec students were protesting against the plan by our provincial government to throw us overboard with the rest of youth in Canada and North America. And that was really the spark for what has now become known as the Maple Spring, which has taken on issues far more than tuition and has aroused and mobilized a population far beyond the students. But it was the planned tuition hike of $1,625 which first mobilized the students to strike and take to the streets.
Does that tuition rise indicate a breakdown of public services in the province?
Well, yes. I mean, absolutely. It's just part of a more global austerity agenda where the banks and the corporations and the politicians who created the global economic crisis reward themselves with more money and more power and more subsidies while they hand the bill to the public and cut back all services that benefit the people at large and force the people essentially to pay for their own private profits and plundering and power mongering. And that's just what austerity is. And this is a part of the austerity agenda. And I mean, if you look at the Quebec provincial government spending, they're undertaking a development plan called Plan North or Northern Plan to exploit the mineral and energy resources of northern Quebec in a region which is larger than the entire country of France. And there's vast mineral energy resources up there. So first of all, they're pushing the indigenous people further off the land that they've already taken from them. And then they're subsidizing multi-billion dollar mining companies and global energy corporations to exploit the resources. They're throwing approximately $80 billion at this project to benefit those who can already benefit themselves. And meanwhile, there's no money for students. Meanwhile, they have to increase tuition, increase debt, and increase essentially a system which shackles students to this system and to debt bondage and to the banks, which are making record profits and which received a $114 billion bailout in 2008, which amounts to $3,400 for every Canadian man, woman, and child. But the Quebec students are called entitled and spoiled because we struggle against the system. But there's no comment about the banks or the corporations and how entitled they are.
We're speaking live with Andrew Gavin Marshall, an independent journalist in Canada, about the student and other issues, economic as well as political. And one of the things we're hearing down south of the Canadian border, Andrew, is that there is also a whiff of repression in the air, that legislation is underway that would severely limit the right of protest and have grievous penalties. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this the recent legislation, Bill 78, was passed about 2 weeks ago. The repression was taking place before this bill passed. It was taking place since the strike began. For 2 months, the government refused to even talk to students, and they had just decided to employ state violence against the students. So at basically every single protest, you would have students were met with riot police who would pepper spray, tear gas, beat with batons, mass arrest people, trample with horses, drive trucks and cars into groups of students, shoot with rubber bullets. A few students were almost killed on the May 4th weekend by being shot in the head and face with rubber bullets. So this has been quite consistent. Bill 78 simply takes it to the next step, and it was passed a couple of weeks ago, and it essentially, well, it does outlaw protests within 50 meters of school property, which is to say there's no such thing as free assembly and freedom of speech on school property in Quebec, and the main universities, especially in Montreal where I live, are all downtown and scattered throughout. So it makes protesting very, very difficult, essentially criminalized in the downtown core. It's also essentially any public demonstration of over 50 people is illegal unless they register at least 8 hours ahead of time with the police, with an entire itinerary, location, duration, route, start and finish for the protest, and the police have a new found right to change or cancel anything as they please arbitrarily. So there's no longer a right to spontaneous protest or assembly. And these are rights that are, of course, guaranteed in the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, our Constitution. But they are all being violated immediately when the law was passed. Even the Quebec Bar Association denounced it, the Human Rights Council, Amnesty International. Lawyers and law professors spoke up against it. We even had a protest right here in Montreal last week of several hundred jurists who wore their robes and walked through the streets of Montreal in solidarity with the students and against Bill 78 with signs reading the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. So Bill 78 is essentially, it also adds heavy fines for any violations of the law. So for participants in protests, you can be fined between, for illegal protests, which are essentially all protests, you can be fined between $1 and $5,000. For student leaders, you can be fined between $7,000 and $35,000. And for student associations, which have been organizing and mobilizing the entire strike, you can be fined up to $125,000 for a first offense and up to $250,000 for a second offense. So it's designed to bankrupt the student organizations. And as one student leader said when the law was passed, it is a declaration of war on the student movement itself. And so that has been the reality of the law. When it was first passed, there were mass arrests that took place. In one night, 700 people were arrested, 518 of them right here in Montreal for peacefully assembling downtown. We've had a total of 2,500 people arrested in the entire conflict so far. This is more than in any previous conflict in Quebec history, and in 1970, martial law was passed in Quebec to deal with a very political unrest situation. And essentially a terrorism situation back in the 1970s. But we've seen more arrests take place here against a student movement. But Bill 78 also had the added effect of mobilizing a wider part of the population against the government and against this freedom-destroying bill.
In response to the protest against the lack of the right to protest, we've just heard, just before you came on, what I think might be a spinoff from the Quebec student protest. And that involves guerrilla actions, that involves unannounced protests of masses of people. And I'm told the casserole variety of protest, pots and pans and sounds like that. Can you finally tell us what new methods of resistance are developing in Quebec?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, as soon as the law was passed, it was passed on a Friday, went into effect on Saturday, and the following Tuesday, there was, on May 22nd, we had, for the third time since the beginning of the student strike, a mass demonstration in Montreal, this time there was one on March 22nd, which drew over 200,000 people into the streets. There was one on April 22nd, which drew over 250,000 people into the streets. And the one on May 22nd drew over 300,000 people into the streets. So that's what happens when you declare protesting illegal, is 300,000 people come out into the streets and protest that law. And then immediately after that, we saw the emergence of the casseroles protest, which is every night at 8, people take their pots and pans, step out into the streets and bang their pots and pans, and spontaneous little protests and marches will begin. And they can meet up with other groups who are out casseroling, and soon enough you have 5,000-10,000 people walking through the streets of Montreal. And this is not just students anymore. You see elderly, you see children, you see strollers, you see wheelchairs, you see waiters and waitresses coming out of restaurants to bang their pots from the kitchens. You see nurses coming out of the hospitals, people from their balconies cheering them on. Musicians come out and bang their drums on their doorsteps. You've really seen something emerge here, and it hasn't been able to be met with police violence. The police declare each protest illegal, but say it can continue so long as it's peaceful, because they simply have no means of enforcing the law at the present moment, because it would be a PR disaster for them if they started tear gassing the elderly and children. It's fine to do that with students, but we're reaching a new level of resistance at the moment. And the casseroles are, in fact, drawn from Chile in the 1970s, from Argentina in 2001. And so it's a very Latin American, it has Latin American origins. And, of course, Chile itself currently is just reached its year-long anniversary of their student movement. And their student leaders have spoken out in support of the Quebec students here. And, of course, Quebec students here have spoken out in support of the Chilean students struggling for over a year in South America. So, I mean, this is not simply confined to Quebec, but we do see solidarity protests emerging everywhere. As you mentioned, in New York, there have been solidarity protests organized by Occupy Wall Street. Last Wednesday, there was a sort of casseroles protests and solidarity taking place in 70 cities around the world, you know, as far south as Austin, Texas, and as far across the water as London and Brussels. All across Canada and in several places in the United States, including New York, people took their pots and pans out and banged in solidarity with the student movement here.
Well, I'd like to thank you very much for joining us on 5 O'Clock Shadow, Andrew Gavin Marshall, and thoroughly describing the noise that is now being heard around the world. We'll stay in touch. We expect more to come in
Excellent.
The days
Thank you very much.
Soon to follow. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and just as Andrew mentioned, there is a tradition of noise banging for protests for justice, as in Argentina with the Mothers of the Disappeared, as in Chile with similar protests. And protest in the United States has gone through many different forms, whether it be civil rights sit-ins or whether it be other methodologies. And to put that in perspective for our theme today of protest, we take a look at one of the more prominent writers on this subject, Saul Alinsky, who published the book in 1971, Rules for Radicals. And some 40 years ago, approximately four decades ago, Saul Alinsky discussed some of the elements of protest with the legendary Chicago-based interviewer, the late Studs Terkel.
If you were to describe Saul as a professional agitator, what would your reaction be to that description?
That's okay with me. That's what you left out one word, Studs. Professional outside agitator. You see, you got to be an outside agitator to begin with, because agitators very rarely come up from the inside. Because if you come up from the inside, one of two things happens to you. Either you get knocked off or you get co-opted. That's the reason all agitators are outside agitators. And, you see, when you're out to really get change, every community, every place is organized. When sociologists talk about social disorganization or that communities are disorganized, that's what they're talking about. You can go into the creditiest community. It's got a policy racket going. It's got a syndicate going. It's got a political organization in there that's crooked as hell. And they're being exploited if it's a company town, but it's organized, you know? It's a contradiction in terms to say that there's such a thing as a disorganized community. So that the job of an agitator is first, it's really not organizing a movement, he's reorganizing it. First he's got to change the whole pattern, he's got to disorganize it, that's why he's an agitator. And after he disorganizes it, then he reorganizes it.
So, we're coming to now something. Then this man who enters a community, this man, this outside quote-unquote agitator, has entered a community that is organized to begin with.
That's right.
And organized for what? And why is he there? See, organized for what? The community.
Well, the community is organized on a certain pattern of values. You can call it an exploitation of the many by the few over there. Call it whatever you want to. The organizer brings in another set of values. Now, to say that an organizer comes in who is just in there as sort of a blotter, that he's going in for just participatory democracy. He doesn't have any ideas. He's just going to be a servant of the people, of the masses, so to speak. He will just reflect what they want. It's just a lot of romantic crap. If an organizer doesn't have ideas as to how he wants to change that thing, and more important, if he doesn't have the sophistication and the experience to know how to get it done, see, there's a big difference between the what's that you want to get in life and the how you go about getting it. If you don't know the how about getting it, you're never going to get the what's. I always used to say that if any smart organizer had come up before the Oracle at Delphi, and the Oracle always sounded off with her usual proverbial business of know thyself, you know. A smart organizer would look at her and say, okay, Oracle, now how the hell do I go about doing it? Don't tell me what I have to get. Tell me how to get it, because unless I know the how, the what is just rhetoric, you know? Now, I imagine the Oracle would have had a fit, you know? Would have said one question aloud only to a customer or something. Yeah. Get thee gone.
Yeah.
That organizer's got to have ideas. If he doesn't have ideas, when he comes in there, if he doesn't know how and what to do, the only thing that his presence does is where the population was 100, was say 100,000 before he walked in, it now becomes 100,001. That's all. It doesn't make any difference there. He can only come in on the basis really of an invitation from the community. I go to Houston, do nothing but to lecture at the University of Houston. I get at the airport, the whole clan is out there in full regalia. The mayor is all over the front page of the newspaper. He's going to investigate the university for inviting this radical down to speak to the university. The John Birch Society's got a mass picket line out there. The next morning, there's a big delegation of blacks inviting me to come in because they'd never seen everybody they hated so uptight. But now, if you haven't got that kind of rep, you got to go about working your way in. And one of the basic things here is whether you really, I should stop and say this, Studs, that this is one field on which you cannot pull a con game or snow job. If you don't like people, they goddamn well soon know it. You know, you can pull a fast job if you're selling a vacuum cleaner or something. You're only going to be with the guy for an hour or selling him a house or a car. But when you're selling people and working with them, you're working with them for hours, for days, for weeks, for months. Sooner or later, they sense it, you know. So, if as long as you respect the dignity of people, then they'll respond to you. Now, that sounds like an old cliche, but as long as I respect you, for example, I can't come to you and say, now, Studs, this is the way you get this thing done, because what I'm really saying to you is, look, you dumb son of a bitch, you've been sitting around here for years, and I got to come along and tell you now, this is the way you get it done. So, naturally, you're going to resent it. You see, freedom of choice, and freedom is part of dignity, is really the right to make the choice. I go into a neighborhood. I run into you. You're on welfare, you know? You're standing on the corner. So we get into a conversation. So I say, where do you live? Over there. Well, where do you expect me to live? I'm on relief. Well, what do you want me to live in, a 14-karat gold palace, you know? No, but Jesus, you pay anything to live there? Oh, come on. Trying to be funny? Well, no, I don't want to be funny about it. Jesus, place looks like it's loaded with rats and cockroaches, everything. You damn well know what it is. What would happen if you didn't pay your rent? What would happen? They'd throw me out my kids and everybody else. What do you mean? Yeah. What would happen if nobody paid their rent over there? Why, they'd... Well, Jesus, they'd have a little trouble throwing us all out, wouldn't they?
Something happening here, and what it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there, telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, listen, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right when everybody's wrong. Young people speaking their minds, getting so much resistance from behind. I think it's time we stop. Listen, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. What a field day for the heat. 1,000 people in the street, singing songs and carrying signs. Mostly say hooray for our side. Now you better stop, listen, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.
the sound of Rise Against, and before that, radical organizer Saul Alinsky speaking with Studs Terkel some 40 years ago about tactics of protest. And here are just a few of the rules that Saul Alinsky enumerated in his seminal book called Rules for Radicals. Always remember the first rule of power tactics. Power is not only what you have, but what the enemy thinks you have. The second rule is never go outside the experience of your people. When an action or tactic is outside the experience of the people, the result is confusion, fear, and retreat. It also means a collapse of communication. The third rule is, wherever possible, go outside the experience of the enemy. Here you want to cause confusion, fear, and retreat. The fourth rule, make the enemy live up to their own book of rules. You can kill them with this, for they can no more obey their own rules than the Christian church can live up to Christianity. The fourth rule carries within it the fifth rule. Ridicule is man's most potent weapon. It is almost impossible to counterattack ridicule. Also, it infuriates the opposition, who then react to your advantage. The sixth rule is a good tactic is one that your people enjoy. If your people are not having a ball doing it, there's something very wrong with the tactic. And the seventh rule, a tactic that drags on too long becomes a drag. Some tips and pointers from Saul Alinsky. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York, and now we are joined live by David McMichael, a historian of diplomacy, a former officer of the Central Intelligence Agency, a senior estimates officer, and someone who has been working very closely with the case of Julian Assange of WikiLeaks. Welcome, David. We just heard a short time ago that there was a decision by the British courts that Julian Assange was extraditable to Sweden. Can you bring us up to date on his case?
Yeah, the decision made by the British equivalent to the United States Supreme Court, this is a relatively new court in Britain, by the way, made a 5-2 decision that Julian Assange, who has been under house arrest in the United Kingdom for the last, 6 months or so now, can be extradited back to Sweden at the request of a Swedish prosecutor to face sex offense charges there. The dispute in the court, which caused two of the justices to vote against it, was that the request for extradition was not made by a Swedish court, as the treaty, a close reading of the treaty would indicate it must be, but by a Swedish prosecutor. So this has been appealed, and in 2 weeks, or a little less than 2 weeks now, it'll be determined whether, in fact, Julian Assange will be sent back, who is, by the way, an Australian national, will be sent back to Sweden.
That is an ex post facto set of reasonings that the court used to say that the treaty must have meant this because we say the treaty must have meant this, Nespa?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
The court, in its ruling that is under appeal because it was not explicitly argued during the prior hearings, seems to be that the treaty of extradition means pretty much what officials say it means after the ratification of the explicit language of such a treaty.
Yeah, well, it's a little difficult to parse legalistically there, but basically what the court decided was that an appeal from a Swedish prosecutor was equivalent, the request for extradition by the prosecutor was, for purposes of this case at least, equivalent to a formal appeal from a Swedish court. So that's what they decided, and by a split decision, and this will be appealed in the United Kingdom, and we'll just see what happens. But
David,
now Assange is headed back to Sweden.
David, the elephant in the room, of course, as you well know, is that if he's extradited to Sweden, there exists the possibility that he could then be further brought into the United States under a sealed indictment of some severity. What is your understanding of that?
Yes, well, this has been speculated upon for a long period of time. Julian Assange has been an object, let's say, of interest to the United States now for over 2 years, since, having organized WikiLeaks, he published through an organization of newspapers around the world, which he put together to do this, a significant number of intercepts of United States diplomatic and military communications, the most sensational of which was the initial one, which showed a United States Army helicopter machine gunning a group of people on the ground in Iraq, and which turned out to include journalists and people who had attempted to come to the rescue, including some children that were there. And the audio portion of this included the U.S. helicopter crew boasting about what they were doing. So it was rather embarrassing. In addition to this, the information provided to Assange via the U.S. Army private Bradley Manning, who was working there in Baghdad with U.S. Army intelligence, included access to literally thousands of United States diplomatic cables from embassies around the world, some of which contained material which one might consider embarrassing.
And most recently, the off-the-shelf commercial espionage agency of Stratfor that included whether or not they are reliable or accurate, the stunning claim by the then head of the organization that he was aware of a secret indictment in the United States of Julian Assange.
Now let me respond to that, because I live here in the Washington vicinity, and I have numerous contacts in and around. And the speculation has been rife for some time that a federal grand jury had been convened in Alexandria, Virginia, which is where a lot of these kind of cases are handled, and that a secret indictment against Assange for violation of numerous U.S. laws, but focusing particularly on the 1917 Espionage Act, has been handed down. Now, this connects with the peculiar handling of the court-martial of Private First Class Bradley Manning, who allegedly was the source for Assange of this material. Manning, and to me as a former U.S. military officer and who worked extensively in communications at all levels for some years, the very lax security handling of these communications is extremely surprising and should be embarrassing in itself. But the point is that Manning, who has been charged under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, Article 134, which is the equivalent of the Espionage Act in the military circumstances, should have been brought to court-martial many months ago. But he's been held now for approximately 25 months and in what I would consider very overly severe and extreme circumstances for much of that time, is the reason he has been held and his court-martial has been postponed for the length of time it has is because it's connected to this mooted indictment in of Assange in federal court that the prosecutors hoped to use Manning as a witness against Assange and guaranteeing him a more lenient sentence if he cooperates. And that's the story so far. But from my contacts with Bradley Manning's attorneys, and including his military representative, Major Todd Pierce, Manning is holding up very strongly and shows no inclination to, at this point at least, to cooperate in any putative federal prosecution of Julian Assange.
We're speaking with David McMichael, diplomacy historian, a former officer of the United States Marine Corps, and a former senior estimates officer of the Central Intelligence Agency. And finally, in the couple of minutes that we have left, David, can you tell us what kind of a watershed WikiLeaks has been? Because I fear this may be the last time that the movers and shakers, potentates and spies and diplomats will have been speaking in what they thought was the frankness of privacy. We've already heard that governmental agencies are planning to have disinformative memoranda and such. In the remaining minute and a half or two, can you tell us how significant WikiLeaks is for transparency and protest against hidden policies?
Yes, well, I this is my take on it. The revelation of this kind of information is considered a criminal offense, of course, because it was believed that this such revelations could disrupt diplomatic and military activities, which, of course, it can, and this was to be discouraged. But what has come out most recently with the revelation in the New York Times a weekend ago and in other publications, which has the shows the administration, the president himself, partaking in White House meetings, deciding who, including United States citizens, will be assassinated via drone strikes or other means, and boasting almost openly about the intrusion into Iran's industrial activities with computer viruses, is that since we can no longer conceal these things in the age of computer hacking, make the best of it and brag about it. That's what is to me, extremely disturbing.
Well, thank you for joining us today. David McMichael, throughout the years, your work and research in helping citizens understand governmental operations has been invaluable. You are with veteran intelligence professionals for Sanity, along with your other journalistic and historical work. So thank you for being with us today, David.
Well, thank you for allowing me to talk, and I hope it's been useful to you and your listeners.
It certainly has. This is 5 O'Clock Shadow. I'm Robert Knight in New York. And the case of Julian Assange has also recently been addressed by an agency called the Rap News Service.
Greetings and welcome to our latest transmission sent direct from the beating heart of this internet. The one remaining open channel where information can travel free from filters and barriers. Today's story, as a shadowy specter hangs over our ability to access and assess the facts, is an honest media the force that can free and restore balance and peace in this far reach of the galaxy? The battle has shifted at light speed to cyberspace, where rebel journalists have made the jump to hyperspace, challenging the establishment's grip on information and are now being pursued by its sinister agents. To learn more of what's happening, we're set to bring in figures on opposite ends of the spectrum. Thus, we welcome our first journalist at hand, WikiLeaks founder, rebel publisher, Julian Assange. Mr. Assange, good to have you back on the show.
Robert, it's good to be heck. I mean back. Hello.
Tell us, what's happened since last we spoke?
Well, WikiLeaks has continued to deliver masterstrokes. For speaking more truth to power than all papers combined, we've been ostracized and greatly maligned by the lamestream media, where balls are sadly lacking, and seen the state's haranguing of alleged whistleblower Bradley Manning. I've been under mansion arrest, tagged by Serco, then the bastards imposed an extrajudicial embargo, cutting off our PayPal donors and credit card flow.
Why? Have you broken any laws or been charged?
No, but a secret grand jury has issued a sealed indictment saying I'm aiding the enemy. They're seeking to extradite me.
I'm confused. Who is the enemy?
Clearly, since WikiLeaks aids democracy, the enemy is the people, you and me.
Okay, to compare to this, we turn to another Australian journalist. His media empire spans the equator, influencing every one of us in the world. It's the Emperor of News Corp, Rupert Murdoch.
Hello, Robert. Tell us your take on journalism.
It's like playing Monopoly against the world and winning. You buy up all the real Fourth Estate, the Times, the Sun, the Sky, and many stars are all mine.
I expanded my news of the world order patiently. Now my Death Star stations are fully operational.
You've changed the face of the news with tabloids, pay TV.
I foresaw that by putting D-List on page 3 amidst a chronicle of crime, sports and inanity, scandalous spam which the proles soak up avidly, my empire would expand globally, spreading the fear, giving me the power to make or crash political careers.
Both of you have transformed journalism's focus by exposing secret dealings or by keeping truths in closed doors. Can you explain why one of you is a rich media mogul while the other is hunted like a criminal interloper?
In 03, the media were feeding us lies about WMD. WikiLeaks is here to ensure history won't repeat. We publish truth instead of lies. That's certainly why we're being persecuted. We're doing journalism right.
You will pay the price for your lack of television. You're headed straight for an American prison. Journalists, take a good look at this rebel fool. What's happening to him soon could happen to you.
If you strike me down, the movement you're attacking will become more powerful than you can possibly imagine. This generation is burning the mass media to its foundations. Truth is a virus and courage is contagious.
You can't knock me out, the Fox. But I see that you are still capable of hacks. The Stratfor leak shows that we are alike. Julian, my son, come over to the dark side.
I'm sorry to interrupt this riveting debate, but to learn more of the alleged leaker and his fate, we cross to the Pentagon to learn what's happening at the court-martial of Private Bradley Manning.
Lord Baxter, how's the whistleblower?
His resistance to the mind probe is considerable. We've threatened Princess Leaker, but she's telling lies. You transmitted secret plans to rebel spies!
I'm not a traitor. If anything, I was doing my duty, and it's the Warren whistleblowers that's unconstitutional.
I've not sensed such a disturbance in the Fourth Estate since Daniel Ellsberg leaked the Pentagon papers.
Bradley Manning is on the side of the law. Your overconfidence is your major flaw.
And your faith in your friends is yours.
Silence, there's a transmission from an Imperial starship. Admiral Gillard, are you dealing with the WikiLeaks obstacle?
Yes, Lord Baxter. I said they're grossly irresponsible and their foundation stone is illegal.
And is it?
Yeah, no. They're within legal limits, but we could invent some new laws to get them.
Not if I can help it. I'm running for the Senate.
What? Is this permitted?
Well, I guess it...
You have failed me for the last time, Admiral Gillard. Enough of this. Send in the sweet troopers.
Hello, ladies.
Take him to the prosecutor.
We have a warrant for your arrest. Don't fight it.
What's going on?
Assange is being sextradited. Ha ha. He'll make a good bride in prison.
Hey, this reminds me of my time in Sweden. The rebels are crushed. We've accomplished our mission.
The world is asking, what will this mean for journalism? We now cut live to a surprise guest to let us know. Wait, is that Julian Assange?
No.
It's Kristin Fraxon.
Hello.
A WikiLeaks spokesperson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Robert.
So can you tell us further how these events will affect WikiLeaks' purpose?
Recent events won't deter us or stop us. WikiLeaks will continue to publish and encourage the disclosing of truth, in spite of the tricks they've chosen to use.
Hey, Obi-Wan, you're screwed! We'll charge you with fraud!
No problem at all. Do you take MasterCard?
My, WikiLeaks, I'm impressed. Do you have an infinite supply of geeks to invest? Tall guys with fruity-speaking accents, deep-voiced, white-haired freaks?
Yes.
Okay, thank you all for debating and providing opinions, though it might at times have seemed a bit like science fiction, where it's always much easier to espy the division between good and evil and who is on which side of the schism. But can't a touch of fantasy also help us perceive that our own story has indeed often been about challenging the monopolies and dynasties which have shaped our view of reality for centuries? And so are the fates of Socrates drinking hemlock and perishing, the trials of Bruno, Galileo, book burnings, the Inquisition, all recurring in the current war on journalism, where speakers of truth are censored and imprisoned? Key chapters are being written in this epic saga, which will set precedents for centuries hereafter. Join us for more reports as the story continues. Good night and good luck, and may these thoughts be with you.
Wrap news on Julian Assange and WikiLeaks with Robert Foster of The Juice Media. This is 5 o'clock Shadow. Thanks to our guests today, David McMichael and Andrew Gavin Marshall. Also to our engineer, Michael G. Haskins, and our producer, Thiago Brozo. Andrea Sears as well. If you'd like to be in touch, please contact us at TheShadow, T-H-E-S-H-A-D-O-W, TheShadow, at WBAI.org. And for 5 o'clock Shadow, I'm Robert Knight in New York.